This is Retro Sports Radio. Visit RetroSeasons.com for more sports history.
Ernie, you've seen so many great players and moments in your 55 years in the booth, from Jackie Robinson stealing home on your very first broadcast, to Bobby Thompson's shot heard around the world, to Willie Mays' debut with the Giants in 51. There are a few others, though, that help shape baseball history, aren't there? For example, Nolan Ryan had 7 no-hitters, and you were there for one of them.
Oh, yeah, that was a great moment. Nolan Ryan pitched a no-hitter against the Tigers, and not only pitched a great no-hit game, but he almost broke the strikeout record. And I think as a broadcaster, I was concentrating as much on the strikeout record as I was the no-hit performance. In the 9th inning, 2 out, nobody on, 1 out to go for Nolan. Norman Cash comes to bat, and he is sent back to the bench by the umpire. His bat is illegal. He comes up the bat with a new bat, pops to shortstop. Nolan gets his no-hitter. And I asked Norman after the game, I said, Norman, why was that bat illegal? What happened? He said, well, Ernie, we weren't hitting the guy, and I certainly wasn't going to get a hit off him. So I went in the clubhouse, and I got a leg off the table and took it up there to bat against him.
Well, here's a very important last half of the 9th inning coming up. Nolan Ryan on the verge of setting baseball history. He is only 3 outs away from a no-hit shutout against the Tigers. And he is only 3 strikeouts away from setting the all-time Major League record in strikeouts. Cash is struck out twice and bounced to second. One more out and Ryan has a no-hitter. It'll be the second no-hitter pitched against the Tigers this year. Norman getting a new bat, and I believe that's going to be tossed out. Luciano does not want him to use that bat. Been ruled illegal by the plate umpire. Oh, Norman gets a new bat. There are 2 down in the 9th inning. Ryan cannot tie the Major League strikeout record. He can tie Bob Feller's American League record of 18. And the pitch to Cash is a ball low, a curveball breaking in. Only 1 strike away from tying the American League strikeout record by Bob Feller. Here's the windup. He pitches, swing, and a pop fly back into left field. Going back, Maioli. He's there, makes the catch, and Ryan has his no-hitter, but he does not tie the strikeout record. He is mobbed by his Angel teammates as he comes off the mound, and it is a no-hit victory for the young man from Texas, Nolan Ryan.
Ernie, one event that took the nation by storm was Hank Aaron's chase of Babe Ruth's career home run record. Being in the American League and not in the National during the time that was going on, what were your perceptions of Hank Aaron's pursuit?
I was rooting for Hank to break Babe's record, but I tell you, it was a tough thing for Hank because he got a lot of abuse about it. A lot of people felt like the Babe should always be the home run king. And I think maybe, you know, in a lot of people's minds, he'll remain the home run king. But Henry Aaron got a lot of abuse that he did not deserve, and he went through with it, and I think did a tremendous job to keep his focus on baseball and finally break the record of Babe Ruth.
Henry Aaron in the second inning walked and scored. He's sitting on 714. Here's the pitch by Downing. Swinging. There's a drive into left center field. That ball is going to be out of here. It's gone. It's 7-15. There's a new home run champion of all time, and it's Henry Aaron. The fireworks are going. Henry Aaron is coming around third. His teammates are at home plate, and listen to this crowd. Crowd is cheering Henry Aaron, the home run king of all time, 7-15.
You've had the opportunity to call baseball games that featured a lot of future Hall of Famers. How about Yogi Berra?
Yogi Berra was one of the smartest guys I ever met in baseball, a great friend, and I really love the Yogi like everybody does. And I was with him on the Veterans Committee. And he came to that committee well-prepared about the other players that we were going to vote on. He had great insight. And I think his sayings are full of wisdom. You know, he says it in a different way, but he's a very wise, wise man.
Our guest is Yogi Berra. Yogi, what about all these stories? Now, we hear all these Yogi Berra stories. Some of them are true, some of them aren't. How did all that get started?
Well, I don't know. I think everybody, when they go to the banquets, they always mention my name on it. You know, Yogi said this, Yogi said that. I guess the one you could really get the truth on is Joe Garagiola, because, you know, we grew up, we've known each other a long time. He got a pretty good idea.
Well, Yogi, if you said all those things they say you said, you wouldn't be doing anything but talking all your life, would you?
You're not kidding. That's the truth. I don't know. Sometimes I say, you know, when we're home, my kids and my wife, and I'll say something, they'll say, there's another one. I said, what did I say? You know, and all that. But usually I didn't say all them things. Some are true, and like you said, some are false.
What do you think Yogi Berra would have done if he hadn't been a big league ball player?
My gosh, I don't know.
What kind of business would you have been in?
I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you. Really. I know I worked in a shoe factory when I was a kid before I started playing ball. Maybe I might have still been there in the shoe factory. I don't know.
Now, you've been a player, you've been a coach, you've been a manager. Which is the most fun in the big leagues? Playing?
Playing is the best fun. I know that. Well, coaching is too. You know, see these kids, you know, if you get some good ones, you know, make you happy and everything. And I enjoy it. This is my 41st year now. And I still enjoy it. I think if I didn't want to do it, I don't have to do it, but I like it. I can't wait till spring training comes along.
What's the kick out of coaching? See young kids develop? Is
right.
that it?
You know, help out the catchers, young catchers and everything. And it is good, you know, to see some young kids come along.
Yogi, what's the most important thing a young catcher has to learn when he comes to the big leagues?
I know they're hard to find now, Ernie. I know that. We're looking for one over there ourselves. I don't know. I think the kids just don't want to do it no more. They think it's
too hard. They don't want to
work hard enough for it. And I always try to tell them it's the best position to play. You have a lot of fun. You get to talk to everybody up there, and you're in the game more and everything. We have one kid over here, a kid named Greg Bijo. We just signed him out of Seton Hall. I don't know if you see him today, but he really wants to play. He's really got a lot of life, and he takes charge for a young kid.
What's the secret of throwing for a catcher, getting the ball off quick?
Well, I see a lot of catchers today, Ernie. Well, I can't show it to you on here. They seem like they catch the ball first, and then they throw it. I always like to go up for the ball, like an infielder did.
I see.
You know, and throw it, because you get, you know, like an infielder. You know, I like to move with my right foot first into the ball, and then you put something on it. You get a lot of the catchers, they catch it and then they throw it. They throw like a lot of flat foot and everything. They do all their movement after they catch the ball instead of doing it while the ball's in flight. A lot of them think they say, well, the hitter's going to hit me, you know, if I start moving.
Right.
And I try to teach, you won't get hit. I let them swing and I tell you, you won't hit me.
Sure.
And, but it's tough to do some of them. I don't know. Like Dickie, when he got a hold of me, my gosh. He worked my butt off every day. So you get used to it. You know, I used to go home after workout, stand in front of a mirror to work on my footwork, you know, just to see how I was doing.
Well, it paid off for you.
Oh, I loved it. I owe everything to Bill Dickie.
Yeah. A gentleman who pitched in Detroit, Jim Bunning.
Jim Bunning was a great guy. I liked Jim. He was a very smart guy, one of the first proponents of the baseball union, one of the strong proponents of it. And he was a fine pitcher also, and was later traded to Philadelphia, where he pitched the perfect game against the New York Mets. And then later on, as everybody knows, he was elected to Congress from Kentucky. And then after being a congressman, he moved over to the Senate and has been a very influential guy. I got a sort of a kick out of Jim's testimony when they had the big test about drugs in baseball. And he made this epic speech about cheating in baseball. People should not cheat. But I remember a game in Baltimore where he was scratching the ball on his belt buckle. And Billy Hitchcock, the Baltimore manager, collected about 10 or 12 baseballs, went to the umpire and said, this guy's cheating. But they didn't do anything about it. But that's part of the game, I think, and I certainly excuse the senator for that.
Sometimes it's all a matter of perspective.
You're right.
Now, some players have had careers interrupted by military service, others more tragically. And the first one that comes to mind is Roberto Clemente.
Roberto was a great guy. He got his 3,000th hit in the final year of his career, and then that December, the big disaster hit down in Nicaragua, and he wanted to help from his native Puerto Rico, and he was sending supplies down there, collecting them, getting money for the folks who had been hit by this disaster. And he wasn't too satisfied because they were draining off some of the money, so he got on the plane himself, helped load the plane, got on it, and it took off and got no farther than a couple of hundred yards before it fell into the ocean, and Clemente gave his life for that cause. So he did a lot more than just played baseball, but he was a sort of a misunderstood guy. He was a guy that the Dodgers had signed and hidden away, but then when Branch Rickey went to Pittsburgh, he knew about Clemente and got him back into the spotlight, signed him for Pittsburgh. Then he made his great Hall of Fame career there.
Holder of the longest consecutive game hitting streak in baseball history, the Yankee Clipper.
Joe DiMaggio certainly was one of the superstars of baseball. He had the celebrity status of a rock star, and he had so much pressure put on him that he hid away from people, and a lot of people thought he was diffident and cool. But I found him after I got to know him, and he got to know me a little bit, that he was quite warm and very responsive. I did an interview with him, and he talked about some of those great pressures put on him by the public and the celebrity that he had.
On the road, for instance, during the streak, where we were pretty much left alone, my roommate was Gomez, and of course he did a great job of screening things. And it wasn't the fault of the fans as much as they were well-wishers, and at times they'd come knocking on the door about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and just wanting an autograph to say hello or things of that sort. And of course we had other people that wanted you to go to banquets or luncheons and breakfasts, you know, all those kind of things. And I would have to say that was the pressure. Now, the thing that I did to escape most of all of that was to come to the ballpark about 4 hours early. Mm-hmm. So there was nobody at the park at that time, and I just hung around the ballpark.
Well, is it true that when you were coming to the park in Cleveland on the day the streak was broken, that the cab driver said that he thought the streak would be broken?
See, I thought all that stuff was forgotten, but I guess it's so true. That's the truth. And I was riding along with Gomez at the time, and Gomez jumped all over me. He just had the feeling. He turned around, he says, Joe, he says, I just have a feeling that tonight is going to be the night that they're going to break your streak.
Mm-hmm.
And Gomez, I could recall, just jumped all over him, you know, and he kind of felt miserable about it because he told me later on, he says, you know, he said, that bothered me throughout that whole ball game.
And then the streak was broken, but you started the brand new one, didn't you?
And that is correct, but I must give a little credit there where it's due. And I think one of the great third basemen is the one that really stopped it, Kenny Kelder, who made two fantastic plays. And I think only a man like him who played along the line and made the long throws just nipped me, bang, bang, just sort of like that, you know. But they had to come to an end at one time.
And then there were a couple of guys whose last name began with G, Charlie Gehringer and Hank Greenberg.
Charlie Gehringer was one of the real heroes of the Detroit baseball, the mechanical man, they called him. There's so many great stories about Charlie. I think one of the best that I like to relate is the fact he's the only Hall of Famer who did not attend his induction ceremonies, because when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, it was the same year that he had decided to marry his wife, Jo, and he had settled on a date. It was going to be out in California, arranged by Marv Owen and his wife. So they'd set this date, and it happened to be that when the Hall of Fame elected Charlie, they picked the same date for the induction. So Charlie decided that it was more important to get married than it was to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Of course, he was inducted anyway, but he just wasn't there. But they used to say that he was a silent guy. He was a great personality, a good storyteller, and a wonderful person.
And then Greenberg.
Hank Greenberg was a true hero in Detroit. He was extra special because he fought prejudice just like Jackie Robinson did later on. And Hank went into the service twice, not once, in World War II, and gave a lot of his years that he could have been playing baseball to Uncle Sam. He was a great slugger. He missed out in the World Series in 35 because he broke his wrist in one of the first two games and didn't play from then on, and the Tigers suffered because of that. But he also hit a key home run when the Tigers won the pennant in 1945 against the St. Louis Browns when he first came out of the service and then was one of the heroes of the 45 victory.
Now, you didn't broadcast any of the games this gentleman played in because he went into the Hall of Fame in 1942, but how about the Raja, Rogers Hornsby?
I think I remember him best managing in Cincinnati. He had a very different way of removing a pitcher. When he wanted to take the pitcher out of the game, he just looked down at the bullpen and give a wave with his left arm. He wouldn't even go out to get the ball. and he didn't allow food. He didn't allow anybody to drink water or anything else in the clubhouse. But he also had a great proclivity for the horses. He loved the horses, and he had his own tout to travel with the team when he was managing Baltimore in the International League. But he was all baseball, and you could sit there and talk for hours about baseball, but if you started another subject, he'd say forget it and walk away from you.
Bob Gibson, one of the fiercest competitors that baseball has ever known. He invented the glare, I guess, didn't he?
He certainly did, Bob, and he was Mr. Intimidation. There was nobody that he would knock down, and he didn't even want to put up with his teammates, you know. One of the guys, I've forgotten who it was, came over to say something to him, and he said, "The only thing you know about pitching is you can't hit it. Get back to your position." And he was a mean guy when he was on the field, but a very intelligent guy and a great pitcher. And when you knew him off the field, he was a terrific guy. But when he was in uniform, he was a great competitor.
Comparable to Don Newcomb, whom we've talked about, and
absolutely
Don Drysdale with the Dodgers. They were all brushback. They'd stick it in your ear if you gave them a chance.
They'd do it. They'd, as they say, knock down their grandmother if they had to.
Trying for number 16 right now against Cash to break the record. He takes his set position. He delivers. Here's the pitch. Swing and a miss. He did it. Another great ovation for Gibson, setting the new World Series mark, 16 strikeouts in the game. Two down in the ninth inning, Horton the batter.
How do you compare or contrast them to, say, the finesse of Sandy Koufax?
I think Koufax had so much natural ability, he really didn't have to be as mean, as competitive as that. He was a good competitor, no question about it, but I don't think he really had to brush back guys so much because his fastball was so effective that people probably had a sense of fear to some degree when they went up there anyway. And he was just so good. He mastered control after a rather slow start in the big leagues, but he learned control, and once he got that fastball and his other pitches under control, he was invincible.
One of the nicest people you'll ever meet, and probably one of the most unassuming superstars you will ever find.
I think so, and it's something that really doesn't go along. Usually with the big winner, we usually think about the mean guys and the competitors, but he was just as you described him.
It is 9:46 p.m. 2-2 to Harvey Keene, one strike away. Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed. A perfect game.
Prince Hal Newhouser.
Prince Hal, what a guy he was. A young guy that was pitching a pro ball when he was in high school, actually, during the wartime with the Tigers. And he had a great fastball, a lot of good curves, and he just blew down the opposition, no question about that. And there was a canard against Newhouser for a while among the voters for the Baseball Hall of Fame that he was a wartime pitcher, but he did a lot of winning when the guys came back. He had a lot of great ball players in 46, 47, and Newhouser was still a brilliant pitcher in that time. And I think he was one of Detroit's great heroes.
He had number 6 on his back and St. Louis on the front of his uniform. Stanley Musial.
Stan the man, what a guy. One of the most personable fellows you'll ever meet. He always went out of his way to be a gentleman. I've been on cruises with Stan and his wife, and we went on a cruise from New York on the QE2 down into the Caribbean, and we hit some rough weather around Cape Hatteras. A lot of people got sick. Brooks Robinson's family got sick, and Stan got sick, and we got to St. Thomas. He said, "Forget it, I'm flying back to St. Louis." He got off the ship and went home. He had a great batting stance, and when I worked in Brooklyn, all the Brooklyn fans loved Stan. They were the ones that gave him the nickname, "The Man." And you'd go to St. Louis and ride on the team bus, maybe from the train station, past Sandlot baseball games, and every kid you saw had the Stan Musial stance.
If you were a Milwaukee Braves fan, it was Spawn and Sane and Pray for Rain.
Yeah, old Warren, he was a great left-hander. Warren Spawn won more games than any other left-hand pitcher. He was a fabulous pitcher who really got his start a little bit late because he'd been in the service. He was in the Battle of the Bulge, and Casey Stengel made a drastic mistake when he was managing Warren Spahn before the war. Warren was in spring training, and Casey wanted him to move a guy back from the plate with a fastball, and he didn't do it. And Casey said, well, you know, if you don't have guts enough to do that, you're going back to the minors. So they sent him back to the minors, and here's a guy who came to be a great war hero in the Battle of the Bulge. A little mistaken identity there, I think.
This man's baseball trading card is the most valuable in all the land. Honus Wagner.
Yeah, old Honus. Of course, despite rumors to the contrary, I did not see Honus Wagner play. But I knew old Honus because when I was at the Dodgers, we'd go into Pittsburgh, and Honus would sit on the bench. And I loved to sit there with him, and he'd chew tobacco, and he'd tell these terrible jokes, you know, that everybody would laugh at in respect of the great Honus Wagner, because he was a very old man at that time. But they said that he was the greatest shortstop of all time, at least throughout most of baseball. Some of those opinions might have changed now, but it was said that you could roll a barrel through those bow legs, but you couldn't get a ground ball through.
They said that no one would ever own the Boston Red Sox fans like the splendid splinter Ted Williams did. The man who came the closest, though, Carl Yastrzemski.
Yes, sir. Triple crown winner, great guy, and he could hit and field and do everything. Had a great spirit, too, and he was an interesting personality. He was a bear-down guy, but I liked Carl a lot. I got along good with him. I knew his father. Father had been a potato farmer out on Long Island outside of New York. Carl sort of came up the hard way, but he made the Hall of Fame and certainly deserved it. And like you said, Bob, there's no question that he's one of the real icons at Fenway Park.
Well, Ernie, with all the athletes that you've had the privilege of seeing, there have been a lot of teams that have accomplished a lot of things, but is there one that stands out among all the rest that you would consider maybe your top team of your seven decades?
I think my top team would be the Yankees of 1961. And I think what made the Yankees so good was they had great depth and they had good pitching. Whitey Ford was a bellwether of the staff. But what I remember about them is that they had three catchers, Elston Howard, Johnny Blanchard, and Yogi Berra. And all three of those guys could catch, play first base, or left field. And I don't know how many home runs they had among them, but it was a whole bunch of home runs. Plus, the Yankees just had a good team. They knew how to play the game. They had great defense, and they had heavy hitting. And I'd have to say the 61 Yankees would be my best team.
I've got a picture that was taken of the Yankee dugout. And I think it was right before one of the World Series games because it had the starting lineup that day with Skowron, Richardson, Kubek. Who was third base?
Boyer was third base, I guess.
You're right.
Elston Howard.
Elston Howard, Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris. Yeah. And the pitcher that day was Art Dittmer. And Art gave you the picture. And also Casey standing there, but he's in a shirt and tie.
No kidding. Yeah. That's great. And they had Ralph Terry.
Ralph Terry was on that, but Art pitched that day, so it was made of that day's starting lineup.
That's great.
And
that's fantastic.
He autographed it for him and gave it to me. Ernie, we've talked about the influence that Paul Richards had on you and the other managers of the teams that you've worked for. Let's go back and talk for just a second, and maybe you can give us a little insight to some of these guys that you had an especially close relationship with. How about Bert Schotten?
Bert Schotten was a fellow from Bartow, Florida. He was a fisherman. He loved to fish. He played ball in the National League, played with the Cardinals and some other clubs. And he was very close to Branch Rickey. When Leo DeRocher was suspended by the commissioner, Rickey called his old pal down there in Bartow to come on up and manage the Dodgers. And he came up in 47 and stayed through 48. Leo came back and eventually went over to the Giants. But Bert Schotten was a very laid-back guy, one of the few managers that did not wear a uniform. He'd wear a pair of slacks, and he'd wear a Dodger jacket. And he lived at the same hotel I did, the Bossett Hotel, when I broke in with the Dodgers in 1948. And I used to ride out to the ballpark with him after I got started with the Dodgers, usually with Bert and with the relief pitcher Hugh Casey. And he was a very wonderful gentleman. He didn't get excited one way or the other. You'd get on the train after the game, it might be a very tough loss, or it might be a brilliant victory, and you really couldn't tell the difference by the manner or demeanor of Bert Schotten.
Now, you also had the opportunity in Detroit of working with two managers who had made their name possibly with other teams. A guy who still owns the Major League record for being fired the most times by the same owner, the Brat, Billy Martin.
Yeah, Billy Martin was quite a guy. Billy came into the Tigers. He'd bounced around a little bit. He'd been a great player, and he'd managed at Minnesota. When he came to the Tigers, he was very popular at first, but as my mom used to say, he wore out his welcome. Billy had a proclivity for, after he got started and establishing himself in a job, he began to carp at the other people in the organization, especially his bosses, and it never seemed to work because you don't criticize your bosses too heavily.
Sparky Anderson, who had managed the Big Red Machine in Cincinnati to world championships.
Sparky was a big guy, no question about that. He had managed Cincinnati to the World Championship. He was a choice of Jim Campbell. When Les Moss was fired, Sparky came in. Actually, Les had a record around 500, but it was a chance to get Sparky, who'd been out of work, and Jim felt like if he didn't strike then, that somebody else would come in and get Sparky. And Sparky had sort of a five-year plan, and actually it worked, because after 5 years, the Tigers had a championship team. Sparky and I walked a lot. When we got to be good friends, we'd get up every morning and we'd walk for about an hour. We talked a lot about baseball, a lot about life, and I think I learned a lot from Sparky. He was pretty smart. He was an old used car salesman who knew how to close a deal, you know, and he could read the minds of his players and get the most out of them.
Charles Dillon Stengel.
KC, named after the town he came from. He was a failed dentist. He wanted to be a dentist, and he couldn't make it. And he came to the National League. He played for Brooklyn, and he played for the Giants. And he was a pretty good ball player, but he was always a clown. At Brooklyn, he doffed his cap one time, and a bird flew out. He hit a home run in the Polo Grounds playing for the Giants against the Yankees and lost a shoe running home, his inside-the-park home run. Then he became a manager, first at Boston with the Braves, and he was a terrible manager because they had a terrible team. Somebody said the best thing that ever happened to the Braves was when Casey got hit by a cab and broke his leg and couldn't manage anymore. But then he went to the Yankees and he became a genius. And later on was a great manager with the Mets. But he was the kind of a guy, you know, you'd ask him what time it was and he'd tell you how to build a watch.
Mr. Stengel, I'm not sure that I made my question clear.
Yes. Well, that's all right. I'm not sure I'm going to answer yours perfectly, either.
I was asking you, sir, why it is that baseball wants this bill passed.
I would say I wouldn't know, but I would say the reason why they'd want it passed is to keep baseball going as the highest baseball sport that has gone into baseball, and from the baseball angle. I'm not going to speak of any other sport. I'm not in here to argue about other sports. I'm in the baseball business. It's been run cleaner than any baseball business that was ever put out in the 100 years at the present time.
Leo DeRocher.
He was very volatile. He would be up one time and down the other, and he'd had feuds with the writers, and he and his wife had feuds, and he had feuds with everybody. Leo had come off the streets of Connecticut in the boyhood where he hung around the pool halls, and he became a pretty good ball player, sort of a no-hit, great fielding shortstop, and then later made himself a manager. But I think the great thing about Leo is he instilled a certain amount of confidence in his players that no other manager that I've ever been with could do. Somehow they would really go to battle for Leo, because they figured that he'd figure out a way, as much as he could, to win the game for them. Some of the players didn't like Leo. Some of them liked him a lot. But whether they liked him or didn't like him, they did play hard for him.
Just as there were characters who managed teams, I guess there were characters who owned the teams, too. And the first name that pops up is the colorful Bill Veeck.
Oh, yeah. Bill Veeck was certainly a character. He was a maverick. The establishment didn't like Bill Veeck very much because he went against the grain a lot. He's the fellow that introduced the midget, Eddie Goodell, into baseball. He played against the Tigers. And Bill Veeck got that idea from a story by James Thurber. You could look it up. And it turned out to be one of the outstanding events in baseball history. Bill also had a lot of good ideas. He would make three or four speeches a day to try to promote baseball. He had a tough time with the Browns because they couldn't draw. The Cardinals were always the number one team there. With Cleveland, Veeck did a lot better. He won the pennant there, went to Chicago. He would sit up all night and talk baseball. And he had a wooden leg that he used as his ashtray. You know, he'd smoke cigarettes. He was a chain smoker, and he'd flip the ashes in a little hole in his wooden leg. But he was a great personality, and he was always reading. He loved to read books. He loved literature, and he was a great guy to talk to. I really love Bill Veeck.
Speaking of innovators, Charles O. Finley.
Yeah, Charlie O. was quite a guy, and again, here was a guy that the establishment didn't like, because what Charlie O. did, he proved when he went to Oakland that he could have a winner over the front office that consisted of himself, his brother, and a couple other guys. Whereas all the established franchises had a table of organization that included a couple of hundred people, and Charlie was doing it all by himself. And Charlie had a young African-American guy that looked like Hank Aaron, and they called him the Hammer. And Hammer would go down and get the lineups and bring them up to us. Then he'd talk to Charlie and sit in the booth with Charlie, and he turned out to be MC Hammer, the great rock star. Some of the guys at Oakland, Reggie Jackson and some of the others, gave him seed money to start his outfit, and he became a superstar in the music world.
The shipbuilder, George Steinbrenner.
I like George a lot. He's always been good to me, and I think he's good for baseball. I know he's got some detractors, but I like to see a guy who has the passion that George Steinbrenner does. He wants to have a winner, and he does almost anything he can to get it. He's a pretty hard guy to work for. He goes through managers like, you know, most people go through socks and underwear, but he's a very smart baseball man. And I think when he got Joe Torre, it was really a smart move. My good friend Arthur Richmond made that suggestion. A lot of people didn't want Torre to come. He didn't have much of a record, but he turned out to be the perfect manager to work with George Steinbrenner.
Now, the commissioner's office. Without mentioning every commissioner and talking about each one of them, one stands out because of a decision that he had to make, and that was A. Bartlett Giamatti and the Pete Rose case. What did he face? What was the big problem as you saw it?
I think the big problem that the commissioner had at that time was what to do with Pete, because the Dowd report claimed that Pete had bet on baseball, and in that case, of course, he should be banned from the game. But Giamatti had a press conference, and he made a sort of a compromise with Pete. In the press conference, Giamatti said that Pete will be suspended for 1 year, then he'll have a right to come before us and see about the suspension. But in the meantime, we've all agreed that nobody will address the question of whether Pete bet on baseball or not. And then about a week or two later, Giamatti had a press conference, and he said to the press, well, everybody knows that Pete bet on baseball. So it sort of clouded the issue at that time. And then Giamatti died soon after that, and Fay Vincent took over, and it created a very gray area for a long time with Pete Rose. And my own feeling was that I really wasn't sure. Pete maintained that he didn't bet on baseball. The report said he did, but we didn't know about the authenticity of the report. And I was in Pete's corner, really. I felt like he had a great record in baseball. He made the most of his ability. He was a great player on the field. He had the most hits. He did all kind of things. He was a team man. He won a lot of big games. And I was for him. But then when his book came out, my opinion changed, because he said in his book that he did bet on baseball. And it looked like to me he was saving the confession for a money-making proposition. And I think a lot of people that were in Pete's corner at that time turned against him as far as getting into the Hall of Fame. And, of course, the Hall of Fame is independent from baseball, but they cannot put anybody in who's suspended from the game. So it's not a question of putting Pete in at any point now until he is reinstated, the suspension is over, and he's eligible to go to the Hall of Fame. Now, whether he will or not, I don't know, but right now my opinion is that he probably should not be in it.
Is this the same scenario that Judge Landis had with Shoeless Joe Jackson?
Well, with Shoeless Joe, they actually had a grand jury trial. The White Sox players were exonerated in court, but Landis had been put in and given extreme power, so he decided even in the face of the exoneration, he would suspend these 8 White Sox players who were on trial. And Joe Jackson was one of them. And a lot of people felt it was unfair because Joe had hit about 375 in the World Series, and it was hard to put a finger on a guy whether he had thrown a game or not, and there were all kind of rumors back and forth. But baseball needed a strong hand at that time, and Landis stepped in and did the job and banished all of them from baseball. And then the Ted Williams later on, you might remember, put on a campaign to get Joe Jackson reinstated and elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I was in favor of that. I thought Joe had paid his penance, you know. He'd been suspended. He couldn't play against the professional players all his lifetime, and his life had practically been ruined by this. And why not honor him even if you did after he died?
Now, you've also had the privilege and pleasure, I'm sure, of working with and around and across the field, in some cases, from some great broadcasters. Russ Hodges.
Russ Hodges was a people kind of a guy, sort of like Harry Carey was later, without the flamboyance of Harry. He was the guy sitting in the bar with his best pal, and they were talking about baseball. And he had sort of a down-the-middle, easy style, very easy to get along with. He'd worked at Chicago and at Charlotte and Washington with Arch McDonald and all over the place, but he was a real professional. He came to the Giants from New York where he had worked with Mel Allen. So he'd been around, and he knew baseball and was a very, very popular announcer.
Back of throws. There's a long drive. It's going to be, I believe. The Giants run the pellet. 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 Bobby Thompson hits into the lower deck of the left field stand. The Giants run the pellet, and they're going crazy. They're going crazy.
Then there's the man who saw everything from the catbird seat.
That was the great Red Barber, who, along with Mel Allen, was one of the first of 2 to go in the Hall of Fame. They were inducted in the same year. Red was a real pioneer that all of us owe a great deal to because he took baseball from a game where the station told the announcer to go out, buy yourself a scorecard, and broadcast the game. He was far from that. He was a true reporter. And it was very tough working for Red because he was a taskmaster. He wanted the very best, and I think it was great for whomever worked with Red that he was demanding. He had all these Southern expressions in Brooklyn, and he had a great advantage that Mel also had of coming into New York and being the first big league announcer that the people of New York had ever heard because big league baseball was not broadcast in New York until 1939.
Big Biker called on for his most important job in his baseball career. Well, everything's the most important for all of these players as they come around. Here it is. Steering Hunt. Biker pump. Delivers. The curve swung on and fell to deep spot to left field. It is a home run. And the New York Giants win the National League pennant and the Polo Grounds go wild.
And then, as distinctive as Red's voice was, the man you just mentioned, how about that, Mr. Mel Allen?
Well, Mel Allen was the voice of baseball, no question about that, because of his affiliation with the Yankees, and they were always in the World Series, and Mel Allen did all the World Series, so he got more national acclaim, I think, than anybody. He had great enthusiasm, he had a deep, resounding voice. And he had a terrific passion for baseball. I think his whole life was wrapped up in baseball. Never married, and he lived with his mom and dad, and everything that he did was wrapped up in his job. He did the Rose Bowl for NBC. He did the World Series, and he did a lot of big events. And he also did the newsreels and was a guy who started a second career after the Yankees fired him in the 1960s. He was out for a couple of years, and then Joe Reichler, working for the commissioner, got Mel a job on This Week in Baseball. And he made a completely new career for many, many years as the voice of This Week in Baseball. A lot of younger fans probably never heard him broadcast the game, but they know all about Mel Allen.
Mickey Mantle at bat with a count of one ball, no strikes. Left-handed pitcher Chuck Stobbs on the mound. Mickey Mantle, a switch hitter, batting right-handed, digs in at the plate. Here's the pitch. Mantle swings. There's a tremendous drive going into deep left field. It's going, going. It's going over the bleachers and over the sign atop the bleachers into the yards of houses across the street. It's got to be one of the longest home runs I've ever seen hit. How about that?
A gentleman whose tenure in Los Angeles rivals yours in Detroit, Vin Scully.
Vin Scully, I think, is the best baseball announcer that ever came along. I think he's fantastic. He had the good fortune of going to L.A. with a good team. Nobody had ever heard a big league announcer at that time. And it was a city of automobiles and transistors, and everybody had to listen because the Coliseum, where the Dodgers played, was such a bad place to see a ball game. You really needed a radio description to go along with it. But in addition to that, he just had great talent. And always did have. He broke in very young. He was about 22, I think, when he started. And my real claim to fame, Bob, is the fact that he took my place on the CBS roundup for football when I was switched to another game. Red Barber had to give Vinny his first job, and that was broadcasting a game in Boston. And he did a good job. And then when I left the Dodgers to go to the Giants, Red Barber called. And by the way, Vinny's mother said Red Skelton called, but it was Red Barber, and he offered Vinny the job to do the Brooklyn Dodgers, and he's been there ever since. He's a magnificent announcer.
Little roller up along first, behind the bag, it gets through Buckner, here comes Knight, and the Mets win it!
Then there was the cowboy from Wyoming who ended up behind the mic in Fenway Park in Boston.
That's Kurt Gowdy, the great basketball player who became a very versatile announcer. He could do baseball, football, basketball. He could do everything. He might not have been the very best in each one, but I think as far as overall versatility, you'd have a hard time matching Kurt Gowdy. I worked with Kurt quite a bit, most of the time on CBS, and he was always on the telephone. He was a great businessman, and he took care of business with all his radio stations while he was broadcasting. And he loved to do the American Sportsman on TV. And I know that he went out with a lot of great celebrities. And Bing Crosby and Phil Harris pulled a big joke on Kurt because of the situation they had on American Sportsman. They were always kidding about always having a phone. And they did a show from a duck blind. And in those days, they didn't have a cell phone. They gave Kurt a real phone to use in the duck blind.
The count 1-1 to Williams. Everybody quiet now here at Fenway Park after they gave him a standing ovation of 2 minutes, knowing that this is probably his last time at bat. One out, nobody on, last of the eighth inning. Jack Fisher into his windup. Here's the pitch. Williams swings, and there's a long drive to deep right. That ball is gone, and it is gone. A home run for Ted Williams in his last time at bat in the major league.
Well, Ernie, there's one broadcaster who was not known as a play-by-play man, but you had a long and very nice association with Paul Carey.
Paul Carey was one of my many great partners. I had a lot of partners, and all of them were good, but I'd have to tip my hat first to Paul Carey because we were together longer with him than any other partner that I had. Paul and I existed together about 18 years as the Tiger announcers, and I think Paul Carey had the best sports voice of anybody I've ever heard. The people around Michigan said it was the voice of God. But the problem with working with Paul was he made everybody who worked with him sound like a soprano. But I was able to overcome that. He had a good grasp of the game. He'd come from Michigan. He grew up here. He knew all about Tiger history. And Paul was just such a wonderful guy to work with and so accommodating. And he had an extra duty in the last 15 or 16 years of working with me. When the station decided that they would not use an engineer, that Paul Carey would not only have to broadcast, but he would have to do the engineering, the only outfit in the major leagues that did not have an engineer. So that was an added burden, but he did it and did it well. He was such a professional and such a great guy. I really have to pay tribute to Paul Carey.
Well, it's my pleasure now for the last time for play-by-play, unless we go into extra innings, to introduce a man who's meant so much to me in 19 years. We just couldn't do it without him. I've gotten a lot of accolades and a lot of attention. Much of it I didn't deserve, and I have to share more of it with him than he knows, Paul Carey.
Ernie, thank you very much for those thoughts. It has been an absolute joy for 19 years to have shared a Tiger radio booth with you. And it's now coming to an end. The Tigers finishing off the season here in Baltimore, but they've got a big 5-1 lead as Milt Kiler leads off the fourth inning. All he had a couple of pitches. There's a third, and it's a 2-1 count.
And then you have the first member of first and second generation Major League Baseball broadcasters. First, let's talk about Jack Buck.
Oh, Jack Buck was a guy that everybody took to. He had a nice, easy style. He had a sardonic kind of a wit about him. He was great in the Cardinal games. He was a big fan of Harry Heilman. He grew up in Cleveland and used to hear Heilman do the Tiger games. He came to St. Louis to work with Harry Carey. And then when Harry left, Jack became the big guy and was there for years and years. And everybody loved Jack Buck, and he was on Monday Night Football, too. And the thing I remember best about Jack in his closing years there, I was broadcasting a game at Busch Stadium in St. Louis, and I was back of the batting cage, and Jack Buck came up to me and said, "Ernie, there's only one good thing I can think about you is that you never die young."
Hey, look at the way he's limping. That's impossible for him to come out and bat. We have a big 3-2 pitch coming here from Eckersley. Gibson swings and a fly ball to deep right field. This has got to be a home run. Unbelievable! A home run for Gibson. And the Dodgers have won the game 5-4. I don't believe what I just saw.
Well, he saw his son move into broadcasting, but another man who saw his son and his grandson come into the business is the aforementioned Harry Carey.
Oh, that was amazing, too, that three generations would broadcast in the big leagues, the only time it's ever happened. And Harry, I think, was probably the outstanding personality among all baseball broadcasters. He was flamboyant. He loved baseball, he really did. And deep down his heart, he was always such a fan. He was quite critical of the players, and they'd get on his case sometime, but it didn't bother him. He would say what he felt should be said, and he said it in a very authoritative manner. And he was a great showman, and I think the best thing that ever happened in any baseball broadcaster's career was what happened to Harry Carey when he began to sing the seventh inning stretch, "Take Me Out to the Ball Game." That was a Bill Veeck production, you know. He talked him into it, but Harry took that to the Cubs, and it reached a great fulfillment at Wrigley Field, and they still do it. All in tribute to Harry Carey.
All right. Let me hear you. A one. A two. A three. Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. If they don't win, it's a shame.